The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the Church in the world, and we discuss those things which help us to reflect on how we make the world more just and more compassionate. We call it Just Love because we just say, just do it. Just love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. And so this week, we're getting real close to the presidential elections in 2016, just probably a week and a half or so away. And I guess from my perspective, I wish they were over about 6 months ago. It would have been a much more edifying past 6 months, but they're not. And from our perspective, our Catholic perspective, being involved in the public square is an obligation of our faith. We need to get involved. We need to raise our voices. We need to let our values be part of the way that we form our judgments as to which candidates we are going to vote for. And so this week, we're going to kind of provide our listeners with the opportunity to hear about our Catholic faith and how two different individuals will see how that affects the judgments they make about this presidential election. Our first guest is going to be Deacon Keith Fournier, who is the founder and the chairman of the Catholic of the Common Good Foundation, a member of the Catholic Advisory Group of the Trump-Pence campaign. And he'll be speaking with us about his perspective and how his own interpretation of Catholic social teaching and how that leads him to the positions he takes. And later on, we're going to hear from Christopher Hale, who is the executive director of Catholics and Alliance for the Common Good. And he'll be sharing with us the work of his organization and how they strive to bring Catholic social teaching into the very, very messy world of politics. So thank you for tuning in today, and thank you for joining us on Just Love. Tom, before we go to our first guest, is there a news item that you want to share with our listeners?
There is, Monsignor. You know, as you will recall, a number of years ago, we followed this story, you know, pretty closely. It was there was a number of girls, about 276 girls, had been kidnapped from a town called Chibok that was in northern Nigeria, and they were kidnapped by the group called Boko Haram. And at the time, about 50 of those young women escaped, but the rest of those young women, some 220 girls, had disappeared, and people had not heard about them. There was kind of a Twitter campaign to kind of find them, bring back our girls. Well, there's a little bit of good news. Back on October 16th, through the intercession of the International Red Cross, the African jihadist group Boko Haram actually freed 21 of those young women and returned them to the village that they were from. It's interesting to note that many of these young women, or nearly all of them, when they were kidnapped, were Christian. Some had converted to Islam while they were kidnapped. And up until the middle of this past month, Monsignor, only one of them, Amina Ali, had ever been found. And she was found earlier this year in 2016 roaming around. So I think it's always important to kind of mention some good news. So some of those girls have been returned. There's some that still have to be returned. But I think from this perspective, at least, you know, we want to report the good news, too.
Yeah. And Tom, I think it's very important for us in this country, where we, I guess, rightfully focus on what's going on in our own nation, to realize the very different circumstances in different parts of the world. And some of the things that we take for granted are just not able to be taken for granted in other places. And so, you know, remembering kind of both the suffering and the realities in other countries reminds us that our church is a universal church. And economically today, we talk about globalization. But from the very early days, we understood as Christians that Jesus was just not the savior of a particular people, a particular race, a particular ethnicity. And so even those who are not Christian, we have concern for them, and we need to make sure that at least they're part of our consciousness as we look at things. So, Tom, thank you for sharing that, you know, sad news, but, you know, at least a tad of good news that was part of that. So let's get into it. Let's go to our first guest as we get within a week and a half of the presidential election. And so I'm delighted that Deacon Keith Fournier, who is the founder and the chairman of the Common Good Foundation and editor-in-chief of Catholic Online. Deacon Fournet is, as his name, as his title implies, is a deacon, and he is also an attorney. So, Deacon Keith Fournet, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love today.
Well, thank you, Monsignor, for having me, and thank you for the good work you're doing through Just Love and also in the Archdiocese in New York.
Hey, thank
and
you
thank
so
much. Tom for, by the way, a good update on the kidnapped girls.
Great. So let me just ask you for a little bit of, you know, we like our listeners to know a little bit about the background. So kind of give us a little bit of where'd you grow up? How'd you decide you were going to become a lawyer, et cetera? Just give us like the little snapshot version so we have a little bit better understanding of your
sure.
history.
Actually, my background will come out in my still lingering accent, even though I'm a Virginian by choice. I was born and raised in Dorchester, the inner city of Boston.
Now, I have to stop you, Deacon. If you are a Boston Red Sox fan, we are ending the interview right now. We are tolerant and inclusive of everybody except Boston Red Sox fans. So either deny it or get off the phone.
But anyway, I am really a revert.
A lawyer who doesn't answer the question.
I was more of a football fan anyway. I was never a great baseball fan, but I didn't want to say that because we're in the middle of this amazing series. But I was always more of a football fan.
Okay.
But anyway, I was raised in a Catholic home, and I'm very grateful to God for that. But my family really wandered from the faith in terms of practice, and I got caught up in the 60s and 70s as a wandering teenage hippie and wandered my way back to faith in Jesus Christ and then back to embracing with great joy what it means to be a Catholic. And that really became the foundation for the choices in my life.
Now, can you
on.
Give us a hint? What kind of do you think was some of the things that got you coming back after you wandered a bit?
Well, I was searching for truth. You know,
okay.
I was a wandering teenage hippie looking for truth and meaning and purpose in life.
Right.
And, of course, I found that in the one who is the way, the truth, and the life. And I had friends who were becoming Christian. Back in those days, there was a Jesus people movement underway. But I couldn't shut my brain down. And I actually ended up going back to Mass after years. And the whole thing came alive. It was a wonderful experience of the beauty of the liturgy. And I began praying, and I went to confession, and fell in with some wonderful Catholics who really just took a hand in helping me recover my childhood faith, but as a young man.
Hey, I'm delighted. On behalf of all of the church, let's thank God that you did that, that you make our community even stronger today. So thanks so much for kind of wandering and wandering back in the direction of the Catholic community of faith.
Well, and Monsignor, that's why I became a lawyer. I was an early Steubenvillian. I followed Father Mike to what is now Franciscan University back when it was just in the middle of recovery and decided to go to law school because Thomas More was my great hero.
Okay.
And I actually went to law school because I wanted to defend all of the children who were unjustly killed in their mother's womb. That's why I went to law school. So my choice of law as a career was deeply rooted in my conviction as a Catholic and a call into the culture and a call to just love, as you call it.
Right.
So that really opened up my career. I fortunately met a wonderful woman who was a convert to the church, and we've been married 40 years. We've raised 5 grown children. We have 7 grandchildren. And much of my legal career has been spent in religious liberty and pro-life and pro-family work, trying to really integrate my two professions. The first and most important, my profession of faith as a Catholic Christian, and then my legal profession. Ordination came years later. I've been ordained 20 years, and my passion for theology continues. I'm continuing to try to complete my PhD in moral theology at Catholic University and did my master's at the John Paul II Institute. So to me, they're all integrated, and I've been very fortunate to be able to serve the Lord and to use my law license and my interest in public policy accordingly.
We're speaking with Deacon Keith Fournet, who's the founder and the chairman of Common Good Foundation and editor-in-chief of Catholic Online. So Deacon Fournet, let's get to cut to the chase because we want to give our listeners the opportunity to kind of hear a little bit as they form their judgments about voting in this election, although if you read the polls, it seems that the overwhelming majority have already made up their minds, but I still think there are some undecided people out there. And so you are on the Trump Pence Advisory Group, which I think, you know, when I read through a little material, is actually a support group rather than merely an advisory group. So how'd you reach your conclusion to support a particular candidate? Because most clergy don't, you know, publicly express their position. We all vote, but we kind of are a little bit reticent about, given the positions we have, of expressing publicly our support for Canada. So how'd you reach your conclusion?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I didn't start here. Okay. I've been actively involved at the intersection of faith and culture for a long time.
Right.
And I started with other candidates who were my preferred candidates. But when it came down to the fact that
who was your preferred candidate?
Well, I rather than speak about them, I'd rather speak about where I am right now.
I know, but Rick, I'm asking a question.
Rick Santorum and Karen are dear friends of mine, and I've supported Rick for years.
Do you know Rick Santorum, when he was in New York a number of years ago, accused Catholic Charities of not being Catholic?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, you might ask him about that.
Well, sure, but I listen, I'm not going to go back in years ago. I have a chance, I'll talk to him.
Good.
Catholic Charities is doing wonderful work,
right,
and God bless you for doing it.
Thank you.
And then I went on to Marco Rubio, and then I kept hopping and hopping. But I'm also a practical man, and
right,
I live in the real world. And there are two candidates, one of which will be the president of the United States. And it became increasingly clear to me that there is a drastic difference between the two of them on what I consider to be the most important hierarchy of values that I as a Catholic have to apply, and that is life, family, religious freedom, solidarity, the social teaching of the church, which is a division of moral teaching. So when I was asked to be on the advisory group, and by the way, that is what it is, an advisory group. We pray every week, we talk, we give our policy positions as we can. I don't work directly with the candidate. I'm certainly happy to have met a lot of the people serving on this group. And overall, I came to the conclusion that as a private citizen, I'm going to have to choose between Donald Trump and Mike Pence or Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine. And I think it's the most consequential election of my lifetime. I believe the next president will name personally, and I've been to the court as co-counsel on several occasions, I believe the next president will name four justices to the U.S. Supreme Court. That in and of itself is of extreme importance. We can argue separation of powers all we want, but we all know the Supreme Court is in a position right now where the right to life of our first neighbors in the womb, religious freedom as a fundamental human right, the right of the church to speak her moral and prophetic message in the public square, to defend the nature of marriage and propose the truth about marriage, all of these things could be put at risk if, in fact, we have the wrong justices appointed. It's serious. It will affect this nation for the next 30 to 50 years. And that probably was the real most important issue that got me to focus on where these candidates stand. And since then, the differences are very clear on school choice, on religious freedom, on the right to life of every single human person. Very, very, very clear. Then there are also other positions that fall more in the realm of prudential judgment. But there is a hierarchy of values, just like there's a hierarchy of truths in our doctrine. And when it comes to life, it's much more than an issue. It's a lens. It's a framework through which we view every issue. Because when there is no right to life, there are no other rights. In fact, the entire infrastructure of rights is jeopardized. And I think that's what's going on right now. And we have watched it. Roe and Doe must be overturned. But it doesn't just end there. We know that the court a year ago in Obergefell took it upon itself with no constitutional authority to simply redefine marriage. We know right now decisions that
except the constitutional authority having been appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, so they kind of did have a little constitutional legitimacy, a little bit more than you do, to define what the Constitution says.
Well, there was absolutely no legal precedent that decision was based upon.
So you're saying the people who decided don't know what they're doing?
that what I'm saying is the court has, in fact, stepped outside of its authority.
Okay.
And just a willy-nilly decided to redefine marriage. You know, they did
so
that
do you,
as well.
What do you think,
when
having said that?
They took the right to life away from our children.
Right.
There is a right to life, okay?
Right.
It's confirmed in the natural law. There is a right to life. Now, we don't recognize it.
Right.
Simply because a court stepped out of its authority.
So let me speak
That's
to
scary.
That to that point, and I think you rightly define what our teaching is, that not all things are equal, that not every position is equal, and you know whether or not you're going to increase food stamps by $10 million or $15 million is not of the same level of importance as the right to life. And so I think, you know, sometimes the discussion I hear is that every single good or every single issue is equal, and you kind of just weigh them all. And I think you properly articulate that there is a, you know, some things are more important than others, and I think that's got to be recognized. Let me ask you, though, in terms of the, there is also, when we say that we're in favor of the right to life, as we are as a Catholic people, isn't it also a prudential judgment as to how much of our energy and time we spend on, you know, the legal aspect of it, and how much time and energy we spend in trying to educate, raise awareness, make sure that people don't have abortions, because nobody has to have an abortion. And in point of fact, the number of abortions have gone down. So while we all believe in the right to life, isn't it one of those prudential judgments as to where we put our energy in actually reducing the number of abortions?
Oh, I think we have to do all of the above. And thank God that you're doing that, and Catholic Charities and so many other groups are doing that as well. But what the court is facing right now, what we're facing as a nation, look, you have two candidates. One actually stood up at the last debate and tried to defend what is euphemistically called partial birth abortion. That was reprehensible. In addition, that same candidate wants to repeal the Hyde Amendment. Now, the Hyde Amendment has saved thousands of children, because it restricts the use of federal funds, our tax dollars, for procured abortions. So these issues matter. And I agree with you, we have to do all of the above. We want to build a culture of life, and we want to be a people of life. But there is a stark difference between these two candidates on whether or not the first right will even be recognized.
So let me ask you, let's move on a little bit. And I think you make an incredibly strong case for the importance of this issue. I was intrigued, however, that that you did say that you reached your position not as the lesser of two evils, because, you know, in my talking to people informally, whichever way they're going to vote, none of them appear to be really happy with either of the candidates. And they say, but, you know, it's a lesser of two evils. I mean, aren't you at least a little bit uncomfortable with supporting Trump in light of his remarks about women and what he said he did?
Well, first of all, you know, I don't know the veracity of those remarks. They disturb me. They're reprehensible.
You didn't listen to the tape?
They disturb me, and they're reprehensible if they're true, but they were also years ago. Now, that's
but
not the
did
point.
You listen to the tape?
Is, here's the, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so you heard
Father
him.
Father Monsignor, yes, yeah. And it's reprehensible.
Okay,
what's right. Important to me, though, is right. What policies these two candidates are going to enact,
right.
Or at least try to enact, when they lead this nation.
Right.
That has not been discussed. Instead, we've gotten into tabloid journalism on both sides, and
absolutely.
It's really tragic.
Absolutely.
But it is where we are right now. So I have to evaluate, as a faithful citizen, and the bishops have told us over and over again, and living the gospel of life on, which one of these two candidates will more thoroughly advance the freedom of the church. You know, let me make this clear.
Right.
Politics is not going to bring about conversion. Only the gospel can. Only the church has the moral authority to do what will be needed to, I'm just going to say it, prevent the continued implosion of Western culture, because that's what's going on. But if the church is not free, if the church is coerced, if the church's positions on moral issues are somehow translated to be political, and then she's forced to stay behind her church doors, this is a serious problem. So these two candidates have very different positions, not just on life, but on religious freedom. Now, the American experiment has a robust view of religious freedom. Notice, it doesn't talk about, in the Bill of Rights, it doesn't talk about the freedom of worship. It talks about the free exercise of religion. That's active. Yeah. And we need to be free to exercise our faith. And the founders saw that as having value, as serving the common good. We're witnessing a soft persecution of Christians, certainly not like the horrendous things we're seeing in North Africa and the Middle East, thank
right.
God.
Right.
But nonetheless, the hostility toward the church is growing. And between these two candidates, I've evaluated where they will move in that direction as well. One candidate supports the Hyde Amendment. One candidate supports the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. One candidate will protect the church to be able to advocate in the public square for the poor, for the needy, for marriage, for the family. One will not. One, in fact, is on record as repealing the Hyde Amendment, is against allowing the church to speak clearly in the public square that marriage is between one man and one woman, and to try to persuade the American public again on the beauty and the uniqueness of marriage and the family. It goes on and on and on. When you get to school choice, the same thing. So my decision is not being made based on which one of these people in the past has not committed immoral acts or committed less than the other. It's terrible. When you look in the past, both of their past, my decision is now based upon what policies will this particular candidate do their best to push forward that will allow the church to be free to do what only she can do, which is to proclaim and demonstrate the gospel.
So, Deacon Fernandez, I say this very directly to you. I've heard very few people, maybe none, articulate this point of view better and more clearly than you. You do a great service to being able to articulate that. My question I'm going to ask is, and I'm willing to bet this, okay? I'm willing to bet that give or take, if you give me 5 percentage points either way, I'm going to willing to bet that half Catholics are going to vote for Trump and half Catholics are going to vote for Clinton. That's, and I'm willing to bet the farm on that one. Okay, and you've talked about unity in Christianity in the church. What's happening where people of goodwill, flowing from their Catholic faith, will reach different prudential judgments as to what goes? How do we deal with that as a church?
Well, I think first of all, we deal with it well in our teaching.
I mean,
we have the compendium of the social doctrine. We have a wonderful catechism. We have great direction.
Yeah, which nobody reads.
That's the problem, Monsignor.
Right. And nobody is going to read it.
So how
right.
can we articulate it
right.
in practical, popular
right.
ways out there and get it to people? The other problem we have is that teaching is staying in the academy. Very well-intended.
Right.
Policy institutes and think tanks
but Deacon Fernay, my question is not about that. My question is, what do we do with the fact that after this election, we're going to have half of our church that has voted one way and half of the church has mm-hmm. voted the other way, and both sides are going to say they reached their conclusion drawing on their faith, their understanding of Catholic social teaching. How do we kind of get our church kind of to work moving in the same direction for the common good?
I think we need to realize that this is also part of what we call the new evangelization. Uncatechized Catholics, unevangelized Catholics at times. With all due respect, and I love the church. I'm a loyal son of the church. I help bring others into the fullness of the communion of the church.
You know what they say, whenever you begin with all due respect, you got to be careful.
Yeah, but I'm concerned, and I'm not the only one. Look,
right.
it's been one of the number one pastoral priorities of our church now right. for years under St. John Paul II,
right.
Francis Benedict, the new evangelization. We've got Catholics who don't understand what the church teaches, why she teaches it, and how they should operate with what could be called best a moral coherence.
Yep.
As they vote, as they participate in the economy, as they live their life. You know, it is not accidental what they were called before they were called Christians at Antioch. They were called the Way. And that's because to be a Christian is to live a certain way, a just way, as you say,
right.
a way of love. There isn't just the religious and then everything else. I mean, the fathers of the council made that clear. They called it one of the greatest errors of our age, the separation between faith and life.
You know, Deacon, let me interrupt, because I want to affirm what you're saying, because I've now been preaching for 40 years, and my preaching over the years has gotten better. Actually, fewer people are walking out on my sermon, so I think that's a little bit, but maybe that's because there's fewer people at church, so there are fewer people to walk out. But be that as it may, I found my homilies getting a little bit more catechetical than they had been, because you're looking at a congregation where the usual symbols, the usual terms, the usual concepts to think about our faith, or even the basic knowledge, is not there. So you got to do a little bit of catechesis before you can get into the more of the homiletic preaching about it. So listen, you got somebody who's fully on board with you in terms of, we got to figure out a way how we kind of evangelize and pass on the faith.
Well, I agree completely, and I see a lot of good things happening. I see, for example, I serve a parish, as you know, deacons are also serving at parishes, and I serve a parish that I love, and it is growing exponentially. Young people, it's a point of destination parish, but one of the things people are looking for, and by the way, many of them have just come into the church. We had last year, we had 12 adult baptisms at the Easter Vigil. That was a marvelous experience. And people are beginning to look for what we have to offer. The problem that I find oftentimes, and I don't preach as often as you, but I preach and teach a lot, is that oftentimes it's Catholics who have been raised in the church who are living in what I would call a treasure chest. Okay, we're surrounded by these jewels that so many of our other Christian friends discover and then want to enter into full communion, and we don't even know they're there. We don't really know what the church teaches. We haven't really been catechized, and that's unfortunate. So we have to find every opportunity we can to share the wonders and the beauty of this way of life that is called Christianity in its fullness.
You know, I agree with you, and I think, you know, going a little bit back to the presidential thing, I think you're right. I mean, we got a situation right now where we have, in our vice presidential candidates, we have a Democratic candidate who, on some of our clear issues, doesn't see the need for legal protection of life in those ways, and that's a problem. And then we have an apostate on the other side who said he had to leave the church to find Jesus. So, I mean, what you're talking about, the need to do evangelization, is really, really critical.
Well, you know, it certainly brings up an irony, doesn't
it? Yeah, it does.
The one who left the church, at least in his positions on the dignity of every human life created in the image of God, is more faithful to the teaching of the church he left than the other one, who claims to care for the poor but has a complete dualism going on because he doesn't recognize the one Mother Teresa called the poorest of the poor, the child in the first home of the human race. And there is a certain irony here. So what will I do? I'll do everything I can to help Tim Kaine, my fellow Catholic, embrace the fullness of his faith. I've written articles about it, and I'll be happy to pray with him if he'd like to and discuss it.
Right.
But at the same token, I'll do everything I can to help somebody like Governor Pence, who's right on life and is a genuine Christian. I would love to see him come back into full communion. I haven't had a chance to even meet him. I'd love to sit down and find out what he meant when he called himself an evangelical Catholic before he left the church. Because, by the way, I wrote a book of that title way back in 1990 before the title was even acceptable in scholarly circles.
I like the evangelical Catholics who pray with us on Sunday at Mass.
Yes.
Those are the ones.
What I want to have him come back into full communion.
Yeah.
But
well,
in the interim,
good luck.
I have to choose between the two of them. Well, you know what? I've seen it happen, Monsignor, over and over and over again.
Yeah. Hey, listen.
The splendor of truth.
Hey, I've taken up enough of your time. As I said to you, I think you have articulated so very, very well a very important position and a very important thing that I hope our listeners have been made even more aware. I hope they take this in, informing their conscience in voting. So thanks for the time, and thank you for the work that you're doing.
Monsignor, thank you for what you're doing, for what Catholic Charities is doing, and for what this wonderful network is doing. And God bless you, and thank you for your priesthood.
Deacon Keith Fournier, the founder and chairman of Common Good Foundation and editor-in-chief of Catholic Online. We'll take a break. The Catholic Channel, just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back at Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Well, Election Day is probably a week and a half away. And even though we hear from the polls that most people have made up their minds, there's always the possibility of changing one's mind. And there are still, I bet, millions of voters out there who are undecided. And so what we've done today is we're having on Just Love people who reflect upon their Catholic faith. They try to look at our tradition of Catholic social teaching, and they try to apply that and reach a judgment as to how they see things and what they're in favor of going forward. And so the reality is that in our Catholic Church, we have people who see things very differently. And so today we're trying to have our listeners experience different ways of looking at things so that our listeners are better informed, because part of participating in the public square is having an informed conscience. So I'm delighted that we're having as our second guest today Christopher Jolly Hale, who is the executive director of Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good. And I'm delighted that he's joining us. Christopher, thank you so much for joining us.
Monsignor, thank you for having me. I really appreciate being on your show today.
Great. So let's get right into it. Just give us a little snapshot of how you got involved in doing this stuff, a little bit of your background that got you to where you are right now.
For sure. Well, I grew up in Tennessee. I was raised in a Catholic family. We weren't particularly religious, but I grew in my faith over time. I was educated by the Jesuits in Ohio at Xavier University. I graduated there about 5 or 6 years ago, and I came to Washington, D.C., originally to work in partisan politics. But I always knew my faith mattered to me. And so I started out my career working for President Obama in the White House and eventually on his reelect campaign in 2012. That being said, I always joked that I was a Orthodox Catholic and a heretical Democrat. So I knew that there was places of my faith that challenged the party, and I was comfortable with that. But I always thought the inroad for me was working in the system itself, and kind of working the inside game is kind of the word we use here in D.C., and doing my best within that capacity. Honestly, after Pope Francis got elected in March 2013, I was back in D.C., back at the White House.
Did you run his campaign?
I did not. Worked in his campaign.
Okay.
I worked in his campaign.
All right.
I helped do faith outreach there, but I did not run the campaign. No one should give me that credit.
No. I mean, how long was Pope Francis's campaign?
Oh, did I run Francis?
Yeah.
You know, Francis' campaign, he had a much better boss than I did. So, I mean, I think the Holy Spirit did a much better job in bringing him to his election than I could have helped. So
although
you're
not old enough to remember this, but if all those rumors are right about what's supposed to be totally secret, he's a little bit of the Richard Nixon Pope, because I think he finished second the last time, but he wasn't down and out. So he came back as the winner, you know, 8 years later or so.
Exactly. I hope he has a better legacy than Nixon does, quite honestly. But I think the at least on the election analogy, it's definitely apt.
Yep.
But really, after Francis got elected, for me, that was a moment that it will be kind of the defining moment, I imagine, at least in some ways, of my career.
Right.
I knew that it was a moment for me to step from inside.
Right.
Mantle of partisan politics, and then really step out and say, no, I want to lead my faith particularly, you know. And so Catholics and Alliance for the Common Good, I took over the organization in late 2013, about 6 months after Pope Francis got elected. And so we try our best in the midst of the difficulties that come about us every day, promote the social magisterium of the Catholic Church, the social mission of Pope Francis in American politics. So we've been around for about 11 years now, and we do this with some success and some difficulty day in and day out.
So, Chris, let me ask you, the previous candidate, the previous guest I had on the show was Deacon Fournier, who is unabashedly a Trump supporter. He's on their support group. Does Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good, do they take a position in favor of a particular candidate, or do they just, and I don't mean just diminutively, but do they really try to articulate the social teaching in such a way that helps people to take it? Which way do you come out?
No, so we're not going to endorse any candidate.
Right.
We're not going to endorse for president or senate or any of the down ballot races. There's no doubt about it that my background and my predecessor's backgrounds and really kind of the movement we started out of what is and was progressive. But
right.
That being said, we really value challenging the progressive movement to uphold the social magisterium of the church. We fight hard day in and day out. I know very well the Democratic Party, particularly on the issues of unborn life, on some issues surrounding religious liberty as well, have, you know, moments of great tension with the Catholic Church in the United States.
Right.
So we like to imagine ourselves being a Catholic voice within the progressive movement and really challenge the Democratic Party to be what I think historically it has been, a party for the poor, for the excluded.
Chris, let me say a word of thanks to you and to Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good, because I do believe that is a critical challenge. And let's just take the issue that is the one that is so important in a hierarchy of values, the right to life, the issue of abortion in this country. You know, from my perspective, I mean, it is gratuitously politically correct to have stuck in the platform doing away with the Hyde Amendment. It was absolutely unnecessary, and it's there. But the other part to this is, I mean, it used to be in some of the Democrats, and particularly Secretary Clinton and President Clinton. I mean, they were very comfortable for a while in talking about, they wanted abortion to be legal, safe, and rare. Well, I haven't heard that language in a long time. I mean, what's going on?
Yeah, no, the word rare has been thrown out definitely in Democratic Party politics and the way we communicate about the politics of reproductive health and abortion. Here's the political reality, and I will just kind of give like a sense of what's going on. There's a sense in the reproductive choice movement led by Planned Parenthood and NARAL,
right,
that the word rare creates a culture of shame around abortions, which is interesting because I think Catholics, we would argue with all our great ministries we have, the Rachel's ministry and the rest, we really would argue that persons who have abortions should not be shamed, should not be excluded from society, should be welcomed into our church and our community. That being said, I think it's very interesting because we would definitely argue that no woman, no person who's taken part of an abortion should be shamed or excluded or taken out of the society and of the framework of our community. We don't think that has to necessarily coincide with saying that abortion is a good thing. You can be both pro-woman,
right,
and pro-life.
Yes.
And I think that's what's interesting. And I think just to distinguish where I stand, maybe with Deacon Yadam earlier, Keith and others, I'm not convinced that either party is truly pro-life.
Right.
I think the Republican Party is pro-birth, but I don't think they always do well to support the woman who's having a child and support the child going through life as well. So I really would like to see kind of the Catholic movements of both parties to really encourage a platform, a society that's pro-life, pro-woman, consistently looking out for those on the fringes and margins of society. But you're right. The word rare has been excluded from the Democratic lexicon for really about a decade now. I think there are different ways that the party could approach this issue without implying that the word rare denotes a culture of shaming around women who have abortion.
Yeah, and I think substantively the issue that's very, very difficult is, you know, there are two words that we use, and I'll give you a good word. I'll give you the bad word first, guilt, and then I'll give you the good word, responsibility. And, you know, so if one acts irresponsibly, should one feel guilty about acting irresponsibly or whatever? I mean, it's one of those things. And if we don't talk about abortion, if we talk about any other issues, you know, we kind of do try to hold people responsible. And we say, hey, if you do that, you shouldn't do it. And I think that's the real, you know, real challenge we have in the world today, to how do we kind of communicate important values, things that we think there with, you know, talking about responsibility, but yet not kind of ostracizing people when people maybe don't live up to those responsibilities.
And I think even more so than that, I would argue, and maybe this is also an area, perhaps slight disagreement with me and your previous guest, is when an abortion happens, I would argue that the primary responsibility belongs to society at large, and not necessarily that person. We can't simply say life, the dignity of life, yet not give people the resources, the relationships, the webs of community and support to promote that life, to give viability to that life itself. So I think we have to be really careful that we're not simply reducing this to a legal question. It's not just the question of the legal right to life, but also can we create the web to support life? And so I guess one of the things I would really like to explore more deeply is I fear that some in the pro-life community look at Roe v. Wade as the pinnacle of overturning the culture of death in the United States. But my thought is that as much as this is a legal question, this is also a question of culture and respect and responsibility and inclusion. My sense of it is these things have to work hand in hand.
Let me just speak to that point. And it's interesting. I almost had a similar conversation earlier with Deacon Fournier, as I did actually this morning with somebody else at a breakfast event I was at. And I said, you know, and this person was very, very, very concerned about the abortion issue and how very concerned about this as a political issue. And it was a very, very good, a very sincere individual. In the conversation, I said to him, he identified himself as a lawyer. I said, so let me ask you a question. Do you really think Roe v. Wade is going to be overturned? And his response to me was, no, I don't. I said, all right. So now let's talk about strategy. If we got a lot of resources, we're going to invest in reducing and hopefully eliminating abortion. Where do we put those resources? What's our strategy? Do we work on something which you have just told me you don't think is going to happen? Or do we invest our resources in creating an environment, responsibility, education, awareness, so that we actually reduce the number of abortions, as opposed to putting a lot of energy in what is probably unlikely? Now, you never know. I mean, you never know. Could something happen? So I'm very sympathetic to what you expressed, that if we are pro-life, if we want to reduce the number of abortions, well, we can't only go down a legal road. There are a lot of other roads that we have to go down. And in this environment, the other roads might be ones that are actually more effective in protecting human life.
And I think one of the things that it takes in this fight is courage from both parties. I actually want to give credit. Your junior senator from New York, Kirsten Gillibrand, is pro-choice. There's no doubt about it. She actually earlier in her life, earlier in her political career, did oppose abortion to some extent. But she was willing to go to bat, and I saw this to happen, willing to go to bat and at least have conversations with congressional Republicans about putting some limits on late-term abortion, if that could be coupled with help for paid leave for mothers, et cetera. So I think what we need is, I think that if you're pro-life and you really believe about this issue and you actually want to make an effective difference, I think there has to be an incredible willingness to work with pro-choice Democrats on this issue. And I think one of the things that we can see is a lot of people in my community, in the progressive community, care deeply about women's equality and women's rights, and that's particularly around the workplace and equal pay for equal work.
So Chris, what I want to do is I think we have devoted to this issue because of its importance, and I think we need to. At the same time, I think let me give you a chance to talk about some of the other things that you think are important that Catholics take into consideration as they reach their prudential judgment as to which candidate they're going to support.
Yes, and I think I want to argue. We can kind of go into the issues one by one, but I'd rather give an argument about a worldview.
Let's do that.
I think so we kind of talk about this Catholic social teaching, and sometimes it gets platitudinal or even boring when we get into the stars about.
I'll buy the boring stuff.
Yes, and I think a lot of us who do this every day find it boring. It's not communicable. It's not easily able to grasp. Here is the Catholic worldview of politics, from what I understand and from what I believe. In Jesus Christ, God became poor for the poor to save humanity. And I think we must do likewise in our politics. Our politics must begin from below. We must have a bias for those on the bottom, the unborn, the immigrant, those without insurance, those who are being treated with racial injustice, et cetera. So those should be the focus in our worldview, our Catholic worldview. You know, Ronald Reagan asked in 1980, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? I think the Catholic question has to be, are we better off? Are those who are struggling better off? Are those who are at the bottom better off? So I think I really hope voters, when they go to the voting booth on November 8th in New York, throughout the nation, and they look at the presidential race and down ballot races, they really ask themselves, from the unborn child to the immigrant to the elderly, to all stages of life where people experience vulnerabilities and suffer from a culture of exclusion, are our politicians really putting their eye out for them first? I think that is the worldview that's so important. I think that's the Catholic worldview in short. We always have a bias for the bottom. And I think that's what I hope voters take into the voting box and into their ballots on November 8th.
And I also think we have a bias toward bridge building, reconciliation, inclusion. And I think we do have a bias to say that there is an innate goodness in the human person. And if some way that we can figure out to come together and talk about it, I mean, I think it's based in our real firm commitment to collective bargaining between labor and management, that the best thing to do is to put two human beings with different positions together and let's try to work it out. Let's work it out together. So I think you're, I'm not disagreeing with you at all. And I think there's even a broader thing where we would want to have, and I think, you know, we come up with these cute phrases, but I think we added a phrase where we said a preferential but not exclusive concern for the poor. And I think, you know, I have worked in New York City with Mayor de Blasio. I've worked with Governor Cuomo. I work with them all. And I've said, but what we need to do is to not play the rich off against the poor while we are, have a preference for the needs of the poor, that they have a first demand on our resources. But that doesn't mean we need to vilify the rich because in order to be preferentially concerned about the poor. And to me, that's the global issue of this political campaign more than others, not exclusively this one, that we figure out the only way we can get any attention is by vilifying the opponent.
Absolutely with you. And I think one of the things I see that playing out, there's a lot of attraction among young people I knew, and in the progressive movement towards Bernie Sanders. And I have a lot of respect for Senator Sanders. He seems to have a deep respect for Pope Francis. But one of the things he got wrong, in my opinion, was this notion of the 99 versus 1%. Yeah. He actually seemed to rail and said that our problems as a nation were completely the 1%.
Yeah.
And it was interesting hearing that as a Christian, as a Catholic, and thinking about Jesus Christ, obviously Jesus is Christ, 1% were very different than Bernie Sanders, 1%. But Jesus would never scapegoat the one for the sake of the 99, no matter who that one is. And so I think you're absolutely right. We need a politics of inclusion, politics for the 100%, if you will.
And I do think we're at a situation where we need to, within our own community, do this. Listen, Chris, I'm going to ask you to come back after the election and talk some more about what our challenges are there. But I'm going to have to go now because we got to take a break. And thank you so much for being with us. And thanks for that. And come back, please, after the election.
Thank you, Monsignor. Thank you to all your listeners out there. We really appreciate it.
Good. We just spoke with Chris Hale from Catholics and Alliance for the Common Good. We're going to take a break and we'll be back in just a minute on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. We had two very interesting guests on, and let me just summarize a little bit. The election is coming up in 10 days, and it is a responsibility of Catholics to vote, to participate. The Church doesn't tell people how to vote, so on Just Love today, we invited people with two very different perspectives. One, unabashedly supporting Donald Trump, saying it flows from his understanding of Catholic social teaching. Another one who, without supporting a particular candidate, said that there are a lot of issues there that need to be taken into consideration. And when we continue, but clearly from a more progressive point of view, the election will probably reveal that Catholics, more or less 50-50, will vote half for Trump, half for Clinton. What we encourage is you to reflect, to vote. Let nobody tell you that a Catholic can only vote one way. The bishops of the country say, reflect on our teachings, use your prudential judgment, but vote for the candidate of your church. Thank you. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.